This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Lessons have been learned, but they haven't been learned fast enough. And so until we come to grips with the fact that we've got this new paradigm unfolding in an era of climate change with a lot more people out there starting fires, all of those homes, those tens of millions of people, will become increasingly vulnerable. And I think that the fires this year are really just a harbinger of what's to come. It's going to get a lot more scary unless we come to grips with it.
Most of us associate Napa and Sonoma counties with delicious wine and rolling hills. But this year, those hills were ablaze. Dozens lost their lives, thousands were displaced, and millions of people suffered from the fire's noxious fumes. This week on Sea Change Radio, our guests are journalist Jeremy Miller, whose recent article about the fires appeared in the New Yorker magazine, and Ed Struzik, who just published a book chronicling the connection between wildfires and climate change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeremy Miller. He's an author, journalist, and a contributor to the New Yorker magazine. Jeremy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So you have a recent piece in the New Yorker entitled Where the Fires in Northern California Came From and What Lies Ahead. Why don't you first tell us what stood out to you as you were researching this piece? Why were these fires a little different than just the average California wildfire in your estimation?
I'm based in the Bay Area. I live in Richmond, and you know, like hundreds of thousands of people in the Bay Area, we woke up the morning after the fires started and smelled the smoke. And so one thing that stood out to me is, you know, so the proximity. The other thing that stood out was just the scale and the magnitude and the intensity of the fires. We had multiple fires starting in multiple places and running down into neighborhoods. And one expert that I talked to, a forest scientist out of Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo named Chris Dykus, said it looked like a tsunami had hit the neighborhood. So I think there were a lot of factors that just made this fire seem bigger, stronger, and more intense than your average fire, obviously, and the damage is unprecedented.
Let's go through some of the factors if you can. Let's start with the wind. What was so different about the wind than usual that contributed to this?
Yeah, well, so first of all, you know, this is it's a phenomenon that happens this time of year in California. It's the shift of the winds from what they call an onshore flow, which is water blowing in up over the ocean and sort of keeping everything moist and keeping the fire danger down. When those winds shift in reverse direction, come from inland, from over the Great Basin, which is the big arid expanse in Nevada and Utah, those winds are dry and they bring warm air from inland and they dry everything out. And so when that happens, we get these red flag warnings and fire danger increases dramatically. And so it's not totally right to say it's entirely uncommon. It happens, and in Southern California it happens too. They call it, you know, the Santa Ana winds. But when that wind pattern changes and things dry out, fire risk increases dramatically.
And California seemed like it could be out of the weeds, so to speak, in terms of its drought. It had a record rainfall, a lot of precipitation over the last year, but that wasn't necessarily a good thing for fighting fires or keeping wildfires from spreading, was it?
Yeah. Well, what I heard from the first responder, the firemen and first responders I spoke with, was that the heavy rain that we got last year and snow is sort of a mixed blessing. What basically it did was cause a surge in grasses and in vegetation that this time of year dries out, but you still have the dry forest conditions around it. So basically, it was adding tinder to the fires, that, you know, that 1 year of rain wasn't enough to change the overriding conditions and dryness of the of these forests, but it created that burst of grass that went up and, you know, sort of allowed these fires to get rolling the way that they did.
So you actually spoke to your dad. That was probably some easy investigative journalism for you, but he was a fire chief in Cambria. Why don't you explain what his experience was and how that relates to this fire?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought he was a good person to start out with. You're right, it was a little bit of an ace in the hole that I have for fire reporting. But he was based in the little town. He was a fire chief in the town of Cambria, California, on the central coast for about 10 years. And he was faced with a similar situation as, you know, what we have in Sonoma and Napa. Dry conditions, houses built in forests and at the edge of what they call the wildland urban interface, which is where you have neighborhoods backing up against open space. And so he dealt with these issues throughout his career in Cambria. And what he told me is that, you know, first of all, there's the wildland urban interface issue, which is a huge issue across California. You've got hundreds of thousands of houses built up against open space. And the key to keeping safe in developments like in housing developments like that is to create what's called a defensible space perimeter around your house. It's keeping vegetation trimmed back 100 feet from the structures, and he said that's vital in keeping those kinds of houses from burning down in fires like this. The other thing is that and it sounds like, you know, the investigations are just beginning, but the power lines played a pretty large role in what happened. And so he told me a story about a fire that he responded to in California, in Cambria, which was touched off by a hawk landing on power lines and causing the wires to arc. And then the bird, unfortunately, didn't make it, caught on fire and hit the grass. And that touched off a very large wildfire.
Just one dead bird can cause a massive fire.
Yeah, you know, the point is that pretty much any, when things are that dry, pretty much anything, any sort of ignition source, you know, spark from a lawnmower, an errant cigarette butt, right? Anything in those conditions can trigger a fire. You know, that was his, and sort of his nightmare scenario in Cambria sort of came to fruition, unfortunately, for the poor people of Napa and Sonoma. You know, it was a scenario that sort of went over in his mind over and over and over and over again. It happened in Napa and Sonoma.
And you cite a 2015 U.S. Forest Service report that basically outlines that not only will these fires become more intense, but the actual season is going to be lengthening.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to be lengthening. It has lengthened. That Forest Service report states that the forest, and I haven't looked at the report in about a week, but I think it said that the fire season is lengthened across the western U.S. by about 79 days since the 1970s.
Wow.
So that, you know, it's not only these fires seem to be getting more frequent, but that the season is extending. So we've got these firefighters, these wildland firefighters, working a lot longer to battle these blazes over a longer period of time.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and journalist Jeremy Miller. So, Jeremy, you went to Sonoma, talked to some people. Why don't you kind of give us some stories that you uncovered in your research for this piece?
Yeah. Well, you know, I sort of went up there and not knowing completely what I was going to find, it was hard to kind of reach out to people in advance because so much was in flux and people were obviously had bigger things on their mind than talking to a journalist. But what I tried to do is just get out and kind of meet people and see what they were going through in the moment. So one place that I went was, you know, obviously Napa and Sonoma, synonymous with wineries. So I visited a winery there and the fires were happening during harvest. And so caught these folks at a particularly bad time. One of the wineries that the winery that I visited was Gunlock Bunshoe Winery on the southern end of Sonoma. And basically it was all hands on deck with the staff there. They were, instead of worrying about, you know, the picking the grapes and bringing the harvest in, they were out. The staff of 20 plus workers were out digging fire lines, trimming vegetation. Part of the property had burned and they lost the historic home that that the owners had lived in. And I spoke with Jeff Bunshoe and Katie Bunshoe, the vice president and son and daughter of the owners. And they were, you know, in full sort of crisis mode at the time, although they were very upbeat about it as well. You know, it was, they understood that running a winery in that part of the world entailed risk. And one of the interesting stories about Gunlock Bunshoe was that the original winery that had been established in San Francisco was destroyed in the earthquake and fires of 1906. And after that happened, they brought the entire winemaking outfit over to Sonoma. And so in some sense, that winery was born out of a great conflagration. So it was part of that, of their history. And, you know, as dire as the situation was, they were very upbeat about this, about what was happening, and seemed to be pretty confident that they'd weather the storm. So I met another person at Sonoma Valley High School, which was one of the shelter sites, named Steve Prohl. He was a worker with the Sonoma Developmental Center. And he had spent the last 2 days, 48 hours straight without sleep, moving severely disabled patients from the facility in Eldridge to the high school. And he was, you know, he was completely exhausted, and the reason was understandable. You know, his clients, the people in the center, were, you know, severely mentally and physically disabled, and had all sorts of needs. And he was saying that, you know, it was one thing to just get them out, but the bigger challenge was getting them the services they needed from all of, you know, from these remote locations. And you know, he was thankful that they were able to evacuate everyone, but was, you know, clearly distraught about, you know, being able to continue to help these folks out. And the other thing that struck me, and I know that there's some reporting happening about it, is Sonoma. There's a economic stratification there. You have the wine owners, the winery owners, and then you have the folks that work in the wineries, the laborers. And I've heard and read that there's been a lot of displacement among those communities. And some of these folks are undocumented. And so I think it's important that we, you know, not forget what's happening with those communities. And I'm going to be doing some follow-up reporting on exactly what happened to the more sort of low-income folks within these communities.
Yes, there's definitely some important work being done by organizations like UndocuFund to try to help these displaced, undocumented people.
Yeah. I was impressed with the nature, you know, the way that people were responding to the crisis. There was a lot of flux, people were moving around, but people were also sort of dealing with the situation and taking it in stride. You know, one thing that stuck out was going into downtown Sonoma and seeing people seated outside at the coffee shop, you know, under an orange sky, drinking coffee and tea. You know, so while this crisis was happening all around, there was also a sense of sort of normalcy. People were trying to kind of move on and press on with their lives. And so that was sort of an interesting juxtaposition. There seemed to be a deeper sense that this is part of life in California in these fire-prone sorts of areas.
Some people with masks on, some people without them, walking around having their coffee.
Right. Yeah. And it's sort of a strange juxtaposition. You know, I read some places saying that it felt like reporting in a war zone to go to Napa and Sonoma. And I didn't get that sense at all. You know, I think there was an orderliness to it that sort of caught me off guard.
Yeah, you were able to get this great quote from Jeff Bunshu, the president of a winery. And he quoted Charles Bukowski saying, "What matters most is how well you walk through the fire." And that kind of, I think, encapsulates the general hardiness of the spirit of people who are trying to get on with their lives in the face of this tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people lost everything. I don't want to downplay that at all. But, you know, what impressed me was the resiliency of those communities. I think that spirit will, and that hardiness that you talked about will ensure that these communities rebuild and come back stronger than they were before.
Well, we'll point to the piece on seachangeradio.com. It's entitled "Where the Fires in Northern California Came From and What Lies Ahead." And I'm sure we'll have you on again as you continue to do excellent reporting. Jeremy Miller, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Edward Struzik. His new book is called Firestorm: How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. Ed, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So when you wrote this book, you didn't expect a major population area in the Bay Area to be affected by a wildfire, but it so happens that the publishing date on this book, Firestorm, is almost identical to when the Sonoma County and Napa County fires took off. Why don't you explain how this is going to be the new norm moving forward?
Well, first of all, I wasn't surprised. I think that's the question I always get. Are you surprised at how these big fires are occurring and there's so many evacuations? And I keep telling people that this is a pattern that we've seen progressing very rapidly. It's like a locomotive going down a railroad track and nothing's going to stop it. And it just keeps going faster and faster. And there are several reasons why this is happening. You know, one, the clear thing is that it's getting hotter. And when it gets hotter, the forest gets drier. And when it gets hotter, you get more lightning. The other thing that's happening is that we've got an awful lot of people who have been moving into forest environments in the last couple of decades. And the numbers really are phenomenal. We've got 46 million single-family homes, 120 million people in the United States living and working in and around the country's forests. And so there are two things that start light fires: lightning, and we're getting more of that, and people. And people start most of the fires, so you get a drier forest, and you got more people, and it's just a recipe for more fires burning bigger, hotter, and faster.
So you've written previous books about the Arctic, and you see a relationship between these wildfires and how climate change is affecting some of the colder regions on the planet.
I do. You know, we've talked about the Arctic. We've talked mostly about glaciers melting and sea ice receding very dramatically, and how it's creating a lot more energy in that part of the world. But something else is happening on land. The tundra and the boreal forest in the Arctic and subarctic are also getting drier, and they're burning. I mean, in 2007, 40% of the area burned in Alaska was tundra fire. On the north slope of Alaska, which was really unprecedented in you know, the last 5,000, 10,000 years. And we're seeing these fires in the high Arctic, or I mean, not the high Arctic, but the subarctic regions, progressively getting bigger and hotter. And one of the reasons, again, is that, you know, we're getting more thunderstorms in that part of the world and more lightning. And the one that just blows my mind is in Alaska in 2015. There was a slow-moving thunderstorm that crossed the interior of the state. And in 1 5-day period, it unleashed 61,000 bolts of lightning and caused 227 fires. I mean, it's almost unimaginable. If you would have told a meteorologist that 10 years ago, they wouldn't have believed you.
We think of these fires as being in the wild, in some of the more remote regions of the planet. But recently here in the Bay Area, we saw that everybody is affected by these, no matter how urban an area you live in. Explain maybe how a fire like the Sonoma-Napa fire can take root, and maybe talk about some of the solutions that are on the horizon to try to squelch these fires before they really can affect large population areas like this.
The big problem in California, and to some extent Washington and Oregon and British Columbia and Canada, is that you've got all of these people, several million people, moving into areas that are forested. You know, it's beautiful. They want to get away from the smog of LA and have a little, you know, a nice garden. But what they do in the process is that they build these very vulnerable houses, in some cases wood houses, next to these forests. They plant ornamental cedars, fast-growing eucalyptus trees, as a kind of a landscaping aspect of their property. And this is all kindling to Mother Nature. So when a fire burns, all that wood easily catches fire. And we haven't really come to grips with the obvious solution is that we've got to have, if we're going to allow people to live in these forested worlds, we've got to have buffer zones between the forest and the houses. We've got to have building codes which tell people you can't have a cedar shake shingle roof, or, you know, if you're going to plant ornamental trees, they can't be highly combustible. We just haven't done that. And, you know, it started in 1991 with the Oakland Hills fire, which was, you know, probably next to what happened this year, the most devastating fire in California history. And their lessons have been learned, but they haven't been learned fast enough. And so until we come to grips with the fact that we've got this new paradigm unfolding in an era of climate change with a lot more people out there starting fires, all of those homes, those tens of millions of people, will become increasingly vulnerable. And I think that the fires this year are really just a harbinger of what's to come. It's going to get a lot more scary unless we come to grips with it.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Ed Struzik. His latest book is called Firestorm. I didn't realize, but climate change also affects wind levels. You write that one of the side effects of all of this sea level rise and warming is increased winds, which obviously will fan these flames like nothing else.
That's right. I mean, you get the more heat you have in the atmosphere, the more energy there is, and you get these temperature gradients that occur between night and day and between mountain and ocean. And so it just funnels the wind to, you know, astonishingly powerful levels. And California sees it quite often. But we're starting to see this now almost continent-wide. Minnesota is now seeing huge windstorms coming through there. Places like Alberta and Saskatchewan in Canada are seeing big, big windstorms. And if they combine with a fire, that's, you know, there's really nothing you can do about it, except perhaps just, you know, there's a funny story. They call that an ABC fire, the firefighters jokingly. It's that all you can really do is A, you know, get an armchair, B's get a binoculars, and C's get a can of beer and watch this thing go. And that's basically the formula.
Well, that's what we've been suffering from in the last month here in the Bay Area with air quality just horrendous. People are walking around with masks on, and we're 50 miles away from it. It's affecting an entire region of millions and millions of people. But ultimately, your book, Firestorm, is a hopeful message in that these wildfires are natural, and even though man is contributing to the acceleration of it, there's some real beneficial elements to wildfires. Why don't you explain?
Well, you know, you just look at what happened in Yellowstone National Park in 1988, where everyone in the United States thought, you know, an American icon was being destroyed. And I think the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, weighed in on at the time. The Interior Secretary weighed in on it. The Los Angeles Times, I think, had it on the front page 33 days that summer. Everyone really felt that this was the end of Yellowstone. But what happened very quickly was that you had berry bushes growing up, mushrooms growing up very quickly after that fire, little tree shoots growing up. It cleared the landscape. And all of those animals that don't really do well in old growth forests, such as grizzly bears, elk, they all moved into the fire zone. And, you know, when you think about it, there was just this wonderful new crop of berries. There were mushrooms. There were all kinds of things that were growing out of there, saplings for the elk, and they benefited greatly. And I think that, you know, the National Park Service has understood this since Yellowstone, is that we've got to do a lot more prescribed or controlled burning, not only to manage fire in their forests, but also to enhance wildlife opportunities. Because in the past, since about 1910, when the big what's the so-called Big Burn fire torched much of Montana, Oregon, and Idaho, and parts of Canada, we aggressively fought every fire that ignited in our forests. And so what we have now is a kind of an imbalance. We basically took over from Mother Nature, and we wouldn't allow lightning to help us regenerate our forests. And I think that that's the beneficial part of fire. It rejuvenates forests. The frightening thing is that we're really kind of moving into a new paradigm where our forests are so dry now that if we let them burn, there's the real potential for them to get out of control. And we also have far too many people living near or in these forests. So controlled burning is really, really hard to do nowadays.
Well, it's a great read, Firestorm. Ed Struzik, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band and Bob Marley and the Wailers. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.